Call to order, House Education Committee, March 16, 2011, 8:07. We're getting a little later, folks. Secretary, will you please call the roll?
Here.
Representative Feige.
Here.
Representative Pruitt.
Here.
Representative Sisna. Representative Kawasaki. Representative Wilson. Chair Dick.
Here. Okay, we do have a quorum to conduct business, and I will make note of the fact that Representative Sisna is in Washington, D.C., representing us, and hopefully in a pretty critical issue. Want to remind everybody to turn off your cell phones. And purpose of the meeting today, we're going to take a look at House Bill 15, Student-Athlete Traumatic Brain Injury. This is the first hearing. We'll hear from the sponsor, take public testimony, and we will hold it for further review. And the very end of this session, go ahead.
I'm sorry, I forgot to tell you that the superintendent of Haines is here, and
yep.
We'll be talking about Haines.
Okay.
You're there.
Okay, we're there. And after that, very, very end of this session, we're going to address House Bill 104, maybe the last 30 minutes of this session, we will deal with House Bill 104. Michael, you there?
I am here.
Hey, guy. Okay, hey. Sheila's zooming in on with Google Earth onto Haines. We can't see you, but we do see your town. So if you want to walk us through the PowerPoint, you have our full attention.
Right, and I've got about 29 slides, so I'll rush through this try and get it done in the 10-minute time I have here. But our opening slide, and they're all numbered, slide one, and I think you're looking across the old Fort Seward, which is was built around the turn of the century to provide an American presence and a United States presence in this part of the world. And now has a lot of bed and breakfast on the top row up there and some hotels and an Alaska Native Arts business, and but still is an identifiable feature of Haines. Thank you, Chairman Dick, and the rest of the Education Committee for my opportunity to show up the Haines Borough School District. This is my fourth year as superintendent, and one thing I have found is this community is very proud of this district and its schools, and there are two of them, and the programs and the activities they offer for students and the entire community are greatly valued. Slide two, of course, many of you have probably come through Haines on your way down to Juneau, unless you chose to take that stomach-churning trip across the Gulf on the Kennecott. But I would invite any of the committee to drop by the Haines School for a visit on your way through if you are heading back after the session. My office is in the high school off of what is called the open area and what was once referred to as the dungeon. So, and I have no windows in my office, and it sounds when I'm in here like you're on the ferry because of the air handling units. They keep a good hum, steady hum. Slide three, we're a borough with the borough manager and assembly and, of course, a tax base that is used to strongly partner with the state, supporting and contributing to the school. Also, we have a big piece of fund called the Secure Schools Act. I don't know how many of you are aware of that, but it's an act that was instituted by the federal government to help forest communities compensate for lost timber revenues, and we're in the fourth year, FY12 will be the fourth year of reauthorization of that act, and it contributes about $300,000 in FY12 to our community and much to the other communities. So it's a sizable local contribution, and often if that goes away, that could mean a significant harm to schools in the area. And slide four, our Chilkat Valley, which Haines serves, we have a population of approximately 2,500 with a pretty diverse economy, you know, commercial fishing as you'd expect, tourism, some government agencies here, and we have a significant number of people here in the community who choose to live here for quality of life. They will commute to jobs. They'll telecommute. We have a retirement community here, and though logging was big in the past, there's still a little mill here, and a lot of people burn heat with firewood. And population, as you imagine, in any tourist community, goes up in the summer. Now we have a burgeoning little house skiing operation going on in the spring, providing an economy. And we also have a lot of other eco kinds of tourism, too. Slide five, our community composition. Very diverse, composed of the original Plunkett inhabitants of the Chilkat Valley, and then the waves and trickles of others who've come over the years. And one thing that came up, Chronicle of Higher Education, which is a magazine, a national magazine, that they did a study of communities throughout the country and the state of Alaska, and they found that in Haines had a 30, just number of people holding bachelor's degrees is just over 36%, which was the highest community in the state for that, even exceeding Juneau, which was sort of surprising. And the state average is like 26.5%. Slide six. Of course, our number one resource is our children. And there's tremendous support for education in this community, including a rich curriculum, and we offer these core classes, career tech, voc ed, PE, art, music, and students have, these are ways that students connect to school and get involved in school. Slide seven, there's a picture of the new addition that we put on in 2007 to the high school. It's the it was the K-5 school, or the K-8 school, the new addition is, and they added it to our high school. There were two other older buildings that have been demoed, and they're closer to the downtown area. And we have around, in the Haines School, 105 students K through 5, 63, 6 through 8, and 111, 9 through 12. For a 280 student total, we have around 27 teachers, and we have teachers for PE, voc ed, music, art, and a counselor, and pretty lean administration, one K-12 principal, and one assistant principal, SPED director, and then parapros in SPED, custodians, food program, library, and my district office here consists of me, one office assistant, and one business assistant. Next slide, that's a picture of the art that was generated through our 1% for art during our construction. It is done by a local artist he and his wife have two sons in the school. Other art was done by other local artists. We've got a lot of them in Haines, and we're very proud of, they gave us good value for our money on the art that was done. And the next slide also shows you a couple of other pieces that were completed. And then our second school is Mosquito Lake School in the Upper Chilkat Valley, the K through 5, with 17 students, one teacher, one part-time SPED, and one para-pro. And it's a true little community school, very strongly supported in the Upper Chilkat Valley. A lot of the border kids who are the kids of our border officials go there too. And go to slide 11 and 12. 12 shows the new little playground we were able to build up there a couple of years ago. And then we have also a correspondence program, Haines Homeschool, which has 12 students and one half-time teacher, and these kids can take classes in school too, and to supplement. They can participate in school events, and our teachers work with the families to evaluate student work. The next slide, 14, I think our biggest achievements is we've been able to sustain a varied curriculum for our students, including the ones that are listed on the slides. And all those things, all the options help kids get kids involved and ensure a higher probability of graduation. Right now, too, we could fulfill the requirements of the governor's scholarship, unlike many smaller districts in this state. We're very proud of the construction class that we were able to bring back after it was been cut in the 90s due to funding, but strong support from the board, the assembly, the borough assembly, community members. And 3 years ago, we were able to get it going again, and their first project was to build a school garage and storage building in Haines. And they've done a great job on that, and as you can see in the picture, it's almost completed. And we're going to have a dedication and bring all those students together and recognize the accomplishments that they've had. Next slide, 16, that's our graduation requirements, total of 24.5. The most recent addition was financial literacy, which we put in place knowing that kids have to contend with a lot of different financial mazes and traps and things with credit cards and mortgages and loans in this modern day, and we feel that they ought to have some oversight of what they're getting into when they do these things. Many extracurricular activities, and they couldn't all be there unless there was a lot of community support and community members getting involved, and they do in this community. Next slide, 18. Our class 2010 profile, which profiles a lot of our classes, we have a lot of kids who are going out for some sort of post-secondary education, and we have a lot of students who attend a lot of different institutions and some pretty impressive ones. We also have this year one of our students who will be attending the Naval Academy next year, and we've had a student attend the Air Force Academy in the recent past, and we're very proud of these achievements. And we're proud that we maintain fiscal discipline. We watch our expenditures. We prioritize resources, try to get as many in the classroom as we can. We conserve. We maintain our facilities. That's important, and it all requires an adequate funding stream. Next slide, 20. And I just wanted to show you a little bit of how we do against an AYP. The top line is Haines. This is school as a whole. Of course, you look at it more closely on different categories, and I've got more information on that. But then we exceed the state, and we've exceeded the AMOs, the annual measurable objectives. But, of course, they're going up in the next few years, and that's a challenge for us. That's language arts. Mm-hmm. Followed by math in slide 21 again, and then slide 20. The next slide, we have one of our biggest challenges is maintaining our student numbers. A lot of schools and districts have their numbers have fallen. Haines took a precipitous drop in the late 90s, early part of this decade, and stabilized out in about 2002-03 to around 300 students, and we've maintained them. And we're having a baby boom in the valley right now. There are about 20 residents who are now having children, so the future is looking rosy for us. And then, again, our challenge is maintaining AYP, and these are the groups that were measured on AYP, and district as a whole, it's not. And also, I want to note on the bottom there, the last few years we've had enough students with disabilities in our district that statistically is then considered as part of the YP equation. And the district, the schools made it because their numbers were smaller than were calculated, but the district didn't make it 2 years ago, but this last year made it by virtue of a lot of effort with working with our students with disabilities, who many who are cognitively impaired and have other. We have 9 intensive students, so it's been a struggle, but actually our scores were some of the highest in the districts, and of all the districts. And when districts and schools start not making AYP, oftentimes it's unfortunately students with disabilities and that category that causes them not to make it. And that was language arts. The next slide, 24, is Matt. And again, the same situation, although we're making improvements. And we've got some challenges there. We understand that. Next slide. This, we have a strategic plan that was put into play last year that was approved after 2 years of working on that. And these are the things that we look to the future that will guide us. We're doing curriculum review, integration of current technologies into curriculum, career technical education. We want to increase our program offerings to find things that connect with students, and early identification intervention to maximize student success in reading and math. We want our kids reading and doing math at grade level, and we have those challenges. And again, on the next slide, we want to maintain an environment here that kids connect to, and that our community is involved with, that helps kids graduate and be a lot more successful. And the next slide, this is our graduation rate, 81.8% in 2010. Unfortunately, out of the cohort that graduated in 2010, we had three dropouts. One is continuing as a fifth year senior. Dropouts are unacceptable to us because we know that their future is greatly diminished without a diploma and without that education. And unfortunately, over the last 4 years, we've had 10 who have dropped out, and that's something that we struggle with because we put a lot of time into those kids, and we take it personally and take it hard when they drop out. You know. Next slide. And so, to make everything work, we have to maintain adequate resources. Just wanted to show you that our personnel is 84% of our expenditures in all forms, including the professionals that we bring in to work with our students and work with our staff. And our energy is obviously our second biggest expenditure. We're told that that's going to go up 17% by our local provider, at least probably this next year. We'll probably budget for 20% to be safe. And you know, we are just trying to keep up with inflation, increasing costs of goods and services. As we go forward, these are all challenges for us, and I just wanted to end with, you know, that we're committed as a community to address these issues as best we can and work with the state and with anyone else to do that, and when we're, you know, well-equipped to circle up, back our hands together, and just like our teams on three, we shout, like the last slide says, go Bears. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Michael. Can I assume from all your photographs that it never rains in Haines? I didn't see one raindrop.
Actually, lately it hasn't been precipitating much at all. It's been windy and blowing this spring and very dry.
Okay. Any questions from committee? Representative Seaton.
Thank you. And I just wanted to know the structure of your classes. Are you mainly traditional classes? I know you were talking about doing some VOTEC and integrating technology, but are you using theme-based instruction, or is it pretty much one academic class and subject at a time?
Well, we do a lot more theme-based instruction, particularly in the elementary and the middle school. It gets a little bit more class-oriented But we are offering some classes. We started in the high school an academy block of two class periods back to back, so that students could get into different things more. You know how some classes just don't fit well into one period. So like instruction or gourmet cooking or digital photography, we block them out. We give them two blocks to work within. And then we've started offering classes like we want to help kids understand and visualize and see. There are lots of jobs in the U.S. in engineering, and we want to give kids that notion about getting into that. So we've really focused on doing a lot more STEM activities. I don't know if you're aware of the science, technology, and education program. It's supported by the government and the U.S. military, and there's training. This was trained on Juneau, and I heard that it may be cut, but we've sent our personnel down there to get trained in that. And in high school this year, we've offered a class in beginning engineering.
Now, any other questions from committee? Michael, it's impressive that I've spoken with a lot of people, and I really would like to check with you about your financial literacy class. That's one I think that we need in lots of places. Also, it's very impressive how lean and mean your administration is. It's good to see that all the most of the staff is out working with students instead of sitting in an office. So I didn't think it'd be possible for you to reduce your staff anymore. Any other questions from committee? Michael, thank you, and I do hope to pass through Haines on my way out of here. I'm not going to go through that long journey, so probably about this 18th of April, we'll stop by. And what do you call it, the dungeon?
Yeah, it's in the back. You just walk in the front office where the principal and all the front office staff are with all the windows and things, and ask them where the superintendent lives, and they'll point you back down a dark hallway there. So you can find me there, and believe me, I jump up and get out of here as often as I can during the day, and I would extend that invitation to everyone of the committee, and the coffee pot's always on.
Thank you, Michael. Good presentation.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, we are going to address House Bill 15, Student-Athlete Traumatic Brain Injury. I understand that there's a committee substitute version M. Representative Pruitt, do you want to make a motion regarding that?
Yeah, I move that we adopt the committee substitute House Bill 15, version M, for the purpose of discussion.
I'll object to the discussion.
Okay.
Can we find out the changes?
Can we? Representative Duin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Seaton, if you want to know about the changes, you're going to have to ask this fella here. Anyway, thanks for hearing this bill. I'm Mike Dugan. I represent House District 25, the People's Republic of Menard. This is Frank Amaduri, who actually knows the ins and outs of this bill, and I'm sure would be happy to answer any questions for you. If I might just make a brief.
Please.
Thank you. House Bill 15 is a bill that attempts to deal with the fact that students, particularly student athletes, often suffer, basically get their bell rung, Mr. Speaker, or Mr. Chairman. I became aware of this when I was down having a little work done myself in Seattle, and the fellow who did it is the head of a committee that the National Football League formed, I think last year, to look into the effects of concussions on athletes. The statistics are that roughly 60,000 high school athletes suffer concussions every year. This bill is more modeled after a similar bill. The concern about this has been sort of progressing up the coast. It was in California, Oregon, and most recently in the state of Washington. And that bill was called Zachary Leistad's Law because it was named after a young fella who received a concussion, went back into the game that was going on then, received another, and suffered severe brain injury. House Bill 15 has got three major elements. The first is to educate athletes, parents, and coaches about concussions. The second is to require that any student athlete suspected of suffering a concussion is removed from play or practice and not allowed to return until after they've been basically cleared by a licensed health care professional. The bill is revenue neutral. We expect it will, I think it has, I don't even know if it has a fiscal note, but I expect it will get one. And it's been supported by the Alaska Schools Activities Association, school district press superintendents, the Alaska Brain Injury Network, Alaska certified athletic trainers, and the National Football League. I ask for your assistance in trying to move this bill forward, and I'd be happy to answer any questions I might offer at this point. I got to run back upstairs. I'm trying to be in two places at once. So if there's anything I can tell you about, I'll be happy to do. Otherwise, I'm going to turn this over to my aide.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Okay, if you would identify yourself for the record and explain the CS, if you would.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Frank Amaduri. I am a aide for Representative Mike Dugan. And yes, to answer that, the first question, the changes in the CS were actually fairly simple. On page 2, the change that we basically made there was that the ASAA, who will be working with school districts on this, requested that the training for parents and students and coaches all be documented in writing, so that the coach and the parent simply says, yes, I went over the material, which is available for free online, and it's pretty simple, and I understand what a concussion looks like and what you're supposed to do about it. And they just simply ask that that be certified in writing so that there's some documentation that the training was received. One other change that we did make was at the top of page 3, which is a continuation from here, it just simply talks about who is allowed to release the student athletes back to play once they've been diagnosed with a possible concussion. Initially, the bill, similar to the way the Washington bill, which is the model bill, was originally written, said licensed healthcare provider. We realized that might be a challenge right from the start in rural Alaska, where there may not be a licensed healthcare provider on hand in every community all the time. And trying to work through that challenge with ASAA and yet not put the kids in jeopardy, we came up with this second line, which says, or a person who is acting at the direction and under the supervision of a licensed physician, which would cover village nurses and such, who actually do, that's exactly what they do. And that would hopefully speed the process up a little bit and not penalize a kid who maybe didn't have a full-on concussion or who was recovered in plenty of time. And those are really the two major changes. Other than that, just a question of documentation and who could release the kids back to play. Those were the two primary things that we changed there. And I would also add, just as a note on that last change, there also is a question, and I believe in public testimony today we're going to have someone from the certified athletic trainers testifying. They're not currently licensed in the state, though they are licensed, I believe in 47 other states. So I think they're seeking licensure here. But they're very qualified, and those are actually the people often on the sidelines who are making this call. And so they also work, my understanding, under the supervision of a physician, so this would allow them to bring their expertise to the table as well. And those are the main changes.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do know that in many villages they have a village health aide, and they're not nurses. And also, I do know that many of the health aides are supervised by a PA, a physician's assistant, or a advanced nurse practitioner. And would that be covered under that?
If, as long as that other person is licensed, I believe it would, yes. Representative Wilson, through the chair.
This
go ahead,
is
follow up.
Under the supervision of a licensed physician. And because it says a licensed physician, I do know that I'm thinking of when I lived in Tok, and all of the villages had village health aides. Now, it's been a while since I lived there, so this may have changed, but at that time there was a physician's assistant that was employed by the Native Corporation, I believe, that supervised these village health aides. So if you could check that out, just to make sure, we would want to make sure that this would be covered by all of that. If that probably would be a good idea to check that out. I'm not sure if it's changed since then or not. And they may, the physician assistant may be overseen by a physician. So.
Easy chain.
Yeah. So I don't know for sure, but.
Okay. I guess my question is, Representative Seaton, do you want to withdraw your objection, and should we be working off of the CS?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll withdraw my objection to the adoption of the CS, and then we can work on amendments to the CS.
Thank you. Okay, with that in mind.
So on that last point, Representative Wilson, through the chair, I will check on that. I believe we're okay because the language is, oh, no, I think actually you're right. I think what we may need to do there is just that second line so that it says licensed healthcare provider rather than licensed physician, which I think was my intent. And
it does say that, though.
It does.
Representative Wilson.
It does say one licensed healthcare provider or two, and because of the word or, I would imagine that covers it pretty good. But
okay. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In a bill we recently considered in the HESS committee, we were looking at licensed healthcare provider, and then there was another term, or exempt from occupational licensing, because we have Indian Health Service doctors that serve in Alaska, and they are not licensed under the state, but they are exempt from licensing. So I would suggest that, and if the sponsor is agreeable, I'd make a conceptual amendment to add that in after licensed health care provider or a person exempt from occupational licensing.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, I don't think we'd have a problem with that.
Okay, and thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move then a conceptual amendment that page 3, line 1, after provider or a healthcare professional exempt from occupational licensing.
Any objection? Hearing no objection, the amendment number 1 passes. Any other question from committee?
Question.
Oh, Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 3, line 12. Basically, the action or inaction occurred if it occurs on school property, that the school district will not be held liable. How do you cover if it doesn't happen on school property? In other words, say an athletic contest is being held somewhere off campus. That's not really addressed in the it's not really addressed in the proposed statute here. Sort of leaves the school district open to be sued.
Representative Feige, through the chair, I believe you are probably right there, and I'll check with the drafter on that and see if we can cover that. Although I know that one of the things that we were trying to do here is in that section was. I thought it was in covered there. But yeah, I will check on that, Representative Feige, and see if we can include events that happen on ground, school events that happen off of the school property.
If I follow
could,
up?
If I could just if we were to suggest an amendment that basically said the on line 12, the action or inaction occurred on, insert, or off school property, would you have any objection to that?
Excuse me, Representative Pruitt.
Can I discussion? I think it's referring in here not necessarily to the school or school district, but to the right there at line 11, a nonprofit youth organization. So, for instance, back thinking in Anchorage, we have the YMCA that we sometimes our schools will play ball in spring or outside of the school's basketball season. And I think that's where they're referring to on here is if it is a like my team played as a team in a YMCA league. Well, the school shouldn't have been responsible at that point in time for us playing in that YMCA league. I think that's what this particular section is referring to, and you can correct me if you think I'm wrong on that.
No, Representative Pruitt, through the chair, I believe that's right. The point of this one was to extend the protection, the immunity, to contractors who are working for the school district, which happens a lot in this state. And one of the examples would be when the high school baseball season ends and you continue on with the American Legion ball. They're actually under contract with the school. And I actually think that the coverage of the intent of the bill is to extend these rules no matter where the kids are playing as long as it's a school event. And this simply says that if the people who are contracting with the school are also following the rules, the exemption from liability extends to them as well.
Does it matter then if you even have a mention of school property or not?
Representative Feige, through the chair, I think it may matter to the contractor, but I will clarify that if we need to. If it's
my intention, Mr. Chairman, follow up. Is just to protect the school districts. I mean, you know, this is a clause in here that is protecting the school districts from liability.
Okay. Representative Pruitt, did you make your point?
Yeah, I think that's what the line 12 and 13 are doing there is it's saying that if that nonprofit youth organization uses one of the school district properties, that the school district isn't held liable for it. Because they do also, as American Legion would be one example, sometimes using the baseball diamonds at the schools, but also there are times where with YMCA we would play at some of the local high schools, even though it wasn't an actual high school event. So I think that's what it's trying to do is trying to exempt them with line 12 and 13. But please clarify. Obviously, this is just a point of just discussion. So.
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, although I think that these are school events. I mean, they're school related events because the school has contracted with these people to run the program. A lot of times the schools don't have the resources in Alaska to run certain sports, and so they'll contract with someone to do it. And one of the American Legion is one good example, but there are lots of others. I believe some schools have soccer programs, and softball is another one that is contracted out for many schools. And so this simply says we don't want to leave the contractor out from under the umbrella of protection as well, as long as they're following the rules.
Excuse me, I'm not sure if I recognize Representative Wilson being here, so I believe since about 8:25 she's been participating. And Representative Wilson, you did have a comment.
I do.
A question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is, and I don't see it anywhere, so maybe it's just a given, and I'm thinking of maybe up and down our street, I see the kids like in track. You know, they run through town and they're playing track, but if someone fell or went up to step on a curb and fell and hit their head or something, I imagine that they would be covered, but it doesn't say anything about on school property or off school property, so I would imagine that that is covered, but you might want to double check just to make sure. I don't see it anywhere. It just talks about if there is perceived concussion and it talks about the reporting, but there are activities that do happen that they're not on school property at all. So,
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm a little bit out of my league here. It seems like we are putting a pretty broad waiver of liability into the law that's not there now. And it seems like I'm beyond my level of confidence on this, and so I think it probably ought to go to the judiciary for that determination. This is a broad waiver that we're extending not only to school districts, but we're extending to nonprofits and others. And so I'm uncomfortable making that decision without having a firmer basis in that. So I like the bill. I like the presentation and everything else, but we're getting into just a specific here where we're going. The whole rest of the bill I agree with. I'm just not sure that the Education Committee can make that full call on waivers.
Representative Wilson.
I believe there are some people in the audience that would like to testify. They were in my office yesterday, and I think maybe they might be able to answer several of those questions.
Yeah. I'm trying to prioritize here, trying to be the folks that are time sensitive, so I'm trying to prioritize. Go ahead, sir.
Yes, Representative Seaton, through the chair, just on that point, one point of clarification on the liability language is that the intent here, it taking the bill in toto, is that these exemptions are only extended if you, number one, learn how to recognize and deal with concussions, and then number two, act properly. So the point of the bill is to simply say this is how you protect kids from further injury. And what we're talking about here is really a second concussion or head injury. The first one you can't do very much about. The kids out there, they're playing, they're gonna run into each other or fall down and bang their head, and it's gonna happen. What this bill says is that you need to recognize that when it happens. You need to remove the kid from play when they show the symptoms, and then you can't return them to play until they've been checked out by a professional. And all of this limit of liability language here says is that as long as you follow those rules, you can't be held responsible at least for the negligence. You have to, as long as you've certified in writing, I do know what a concussion is, and then you did remove the kid from play, it limits the liability. But it doesn't really, it certainly doesn't change the ability of anyone to bring a suit against the school, and it also doesn't release anyone from liability if they're actually negligent, which is to say if they knew what a concussion looked like and they returned the kid to play anyway, it certainly doesn't release them from liability at that point. And anyone could still bring a suit.
Thank you. Perhaps we should hear some of the testimony, and then we can get back with some, come up with better questions. Kenneth Edmonds, are you online? If you are, would you please identify yourself and who you represent and give your testimony?
Sure. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Kenneth Edmonds. I'm Director of Government Relations and Public Policy for the National Football League. And I thank the committee for holding today's hearing and providing me this opportunity to testify by phone. The NFL is a strong supporter of this youth concussion education and prevention bill. On behalf of NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell, I applaud Representative Dugan and all of the sponsors of this legislation. House Bill 15 will help to prevent preventable brain injuries and make sports and recreational activities safer for Alaska's youth athletes. The NFL is playing a leading role in addressing the issue of concussions. We put player safety first and want to help do the same for athletes in all sports at all levels, especially young people. The league has strict return-to-play guidelines that apply to some of the best athletes in the world. We believe a similar approach is necessary when dealing with some of the youngest athletes. After all, children and teens are more likely to get a concussion and take longer to recover than adults. Yet a recent study estimated that more than 40% of high school athletes return to participate in school athletics before they have fully recovered from these brain injuries. That is why the NFL, along with leaders in medicine, education, sports, and government, has undertaken a state-level advocacy effort to promote youth concussion laws similar to the 2009 Zachary Leistead law in the state of Washington. Representative Dugan touched on the origins of the Leistead law in the state of Washington, so let me just reiterate and underscore what he said. That law in the state of Washington was named for Zachary Leistead, who at age 13 returned to a middle school football game after sustaining an undiagnosed concussion. He sustained further head blows during the second half, and at the end of the game, he collapsed in his father's arms and lapsed into a coma. Zachary survived but continues to face a long road of rehabilitation. Our efforts are inspired not only by Zach's story, but also by his courage. And House Bill 15, like the Leistead Law, contains the three core principles that Representative Dugan talked about. That's first, concussion education for youth athletes, parents, and coaches. Second, immediate removal of a youth athlete who appears to have suffered a concussion from player practice. And three, mandatory clearance of that youth athlete by a licensed healthcare provider who is trained in the evaluation and management of concussions. This bill will make youth sports and recreational activities better by making them safer. It will ensure that a youth athlete who sustains a concussion has the necessary time to heal and will not be at risk of further, more serious injury in an even longer, more difficult recovery. It also will help to reinforce on Alaska's playing fields the same rule governing NFL football fields. And that is this: the medical decisions of healthcare professionals take precedent over the playing decisions of coaches and players. In the past 20 months, Leistead-type laws have passed in 9 states, including Washington, Oregon, Oklahoma, and New Mexico, and is being actively considered in about 15 to 20 other states this year. When this law passes, parents, coaches, and teachers and school officials will benefit, and most importantly, so will Alaska's kids. The NFL believes that that is a winning game plan. Mr. Chairman, thanks again for allowing me to testify, and that concludes my statement.
Any questions from committee? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, and I don't know if this is specific to Alaska law, but generally, are there other statutes in the states that are considering this that work on the prevention side of things? I mean, if kids are playing hockey at school without wearing hockey helmets, I mean, do we have basically a one free pass, one free concussion here before we do the medical evaluation, or is that generally covered in other statutes that the safety gear that is recognized as being necessary for a sport, whether it's skateboarding with a helmet or not, or, you know, like I say, hockey games on school property or those kind of things. I don't see any mention of the prevention of the first concussion in here. And can you tell me if that's normally contained in these
sure.
statutes?
Sure. I appreciate the question. And I think that we certainly don't want to go beyond the four corners of the legislation. And I don't mean to sound alarm bells, but as Representative Dugan's aide testified, it's very difficult to prevent the first concussion from happening. Even with proper equipment, there concussions happen. They happen in sports, and they happen outside of sports. And what this bill intends to do is to raise the awareness among not only youth athletes and parents, but also school officials and coaches about the dangers of these brain injuries, and even more importantly, the heightened risk of getting a second concussion. And those second concussions, on top of a first concussion, in which the person suffering the concussion has not had the adequate time to recover from the initial concussion, really exposes youth to greater injury and chronic impairment, and in some cases, even death. And so that is why we must do all we can. While we can't prevent concussions from occurring, we can make sure that youth athletes have the necessary time in order to heal from them. And that's really what the goal of the legislation, I think, is all about.
Thank you. Excuse me, Kenneth, do you have your testimony? Do you have that in writing?
I do.
Could you fax that to us? So we'd really appreciate that. Do you have a pen?
I do.
907-465-2197. We'd appreciate to have that in writing. Thank you, Kenneth.
I'll certainly provide it to the committee. Thank you.
And any other questions from committee? Okay. And hopefully I prioritized correctly here. Judy Elegy, are you here? You did not? Oops.
No.
I'm sorry. Here I had you priority.
Here's your chance.
Pamela Lloyd.
That's myself. I thought I put no. Oh.
There's no for both.
No, no. Okay, forgive me.
Donald Cantor's no.
Donald Cantor, no. Okay, forgive me. Brief at ease. Forgive me for not paying close attention to the far right column. You folks that came to testify, you didn't sign here, which is totally forgivable, but I really, we really do want to hear from you, and since you've come all this way to do that. So, if you would like to testify, would you please come and identify yourself for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. My name is Brenda Sheldon. I'm here from the Mat-Su Valley. I've been a certified athletic trainer since 1991.
Good morning, representatives. My name is Christopher Dean. I'm from Fairbanks. I've been a certified athletic trainer since 1996. We're here together representing the Alaska Athletic Trainers Association, putting our full support behind this bill that's before you today. Concussions play a major role in athletics. For years, they've been underreported. For years, they've been considered a non-injury because you can't see the physical signs of an injury. This is a very serious problem affecting youth today. It's estimated that between the age of 5 and 18 years old, every year there's 135,000 children who are taken to the emergency room for concussions. In high school alone, there's 300,000 concussions a year as a conservative estimate. 25% of those occur in football. This bill takes the responsibility of determining when a child is in trouble and puts it on everybody. It gives everybody the power to say, wow, we've got a problem. Let's pull that child out of the situation that he's in trouble in. Let's get him evaluated and make sure everything's right before we allow him to take more risk. Contact sports in themselves are a risk. There's no way to remove the risk of head injury. This bill only allows us one more tool to try to help prevent further, more serious injuries from occurring. Our association is committed to this bill. Brenda's going to speak to you a little bit about the educational aspect of what we anticipate doing. And I thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
The Alaska Athletic Trainers Association.
Excuse me, Brenda, just identify yourself for the record.
Brenda Sheldon. The Alaska Athletic Trainers are medical professionals here in Alaska, and one of our roles is educational. And we support this bill, and in doing so are committed. The entire organization is committed to the educational piece, which means that we bring to the athlete, we bring to the parents, we bring to the coaches those signs and symptoms so that there's that comfort level in reporting, there is that comfort level in return to play. So as medical professionals, we are committed to doing that. You have the full support of the Alaska Athletic Trainers in doing so. And we will hope that we will be asked back at any point in time to report on our successes and how we're doing in all aspects of this. There are many tools available to us that are already in place. The CDC, the NFL, as you just heard, are all very, very committed to this. There are standards out there that we can apply. They're already available to us. We feel this is a very, very doable thing. We feel that we would be successful in doing this, working with the Alaska School Association, and we feel that this is something that our student athletes deserve. And we appreciate your time today, and thank you for having the opportunity.
Thank you. Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. 25% due to football. What are some of the other sports that have a higher occurrence, if you will, of concussions?
Well, certainly the two big sports are hockey and football, and in turn, those are two of the three largest areas right now that research is coming out of. The third large area research is coming out of is the military, because of the traumatic brain injury suffered during combat. As far as sporting events, football, hockey, basketball is another large one. Cheerleading, surprisingly, sees on a national basis, sees a large amount of concussions. Wrestling sees a fair amount of concussions. But the truth is, every sport has concussions, and it's so often underreported because for as long as I know I've been alive, coaches look at you and don't recognize that you're injured because you have something that's internal, and they really encourage you to go back. So you're taught and trained that you're soft if you don't go back and keep playing unless you have a real injury. And so we're trying to educate not only the coaches, but the kids and the parents, that a concussion is a real injury. It's something that needs to be managed properly and do everything right for their safety.
Okay. And follow up. And perhaps Representative Wilson can back me up on this one, but just to clarify, a concussion is a bruising of the brain, correct?
It doesn't necessarily have to be a bruising of the brain. Okay. It is an interruption in the normal function of the brain. There's some very complex chemical reactions that occur in the brain that, with trauma, are altered. They don't know all of the mechanism yet. Again, lots is coming out in research every year. Most concussions will show no signs on a CT scan. You would not see bleeding in the brain. It's very rare, actually, to see the bleeding in the brain, and those are the more significant higher injury concussions that you see on CT scan or MRI.
Okay. Thank you. And for the record, Representative Kawasaki has joined us. Any other questions from committee? Representative Wilson.
I guess, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess my concern is, can you kind of go into, you said that you want to help educate. Can you give us some examples?
For example, the Heads Up program is a series of CD discs that are available that you can either receive free or you can purchase for a real nominal fee. They're easy to watch because they are geared toward the athlete. They actually give examples. They'll actually show a collision. They'll talk a little bit about signs and symptoms. They'll talk about expectations for reporting. They'll talk about consequences of not, meaning further injury or having to be removed from play for the rest of the season. So there are educational pieces that you can give to the coaches to show to the students, or as an athletic trainer, you can ask for or present the opportunity to go in and speak to them about just those things, about what are the symptoms, what should you be reporting. And there's a difference between what we would see when there's a concussion and the symptoms that they'll have when there's a concussion. And you really need to bring those to light, meaning this is what you might find are your symptoms. And then when you talk to the parents, you would say, these are what you might see even if they're not willing to report the symptoms to you. So those are the kind of educational things we would do. So, and then there's also the education to the athletic directors as to the expectations of the coaches or the ramifications of not reporting or not following the pulling them out of play and making the return to play decisions by a medical professional.
And Representative Wilson, the, you know, one of the key aspects of the educational process for us is so often a student athlete gets a concussion, they only show symptoms for 5 minutes or so. It's relatively quick that they get back, and then they're telling their coach, I'm ready to go, coach, I feel great. And so the educational aspect is another fold to get those coaches to understand that just because the kid's telling you they feel great doesn't mean they're healed yet. That's very common. You know, the vast majority of concussions resolve relatively quickly with the visible symptoms, the, you know, the blurry vision, the headaches, the dizziness. So, you know, to get the administrative staff, the coaches, the teachers to all understand that just because they're not able to see those symptoms does not mean the child's not injured still.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. In the bill on page 2, lines 25 and 6, it says a student who is suspected of having sustained a concussion during a practice or a game shall be immediately removed from the practice or the game. It's not saying who's going to do that. Can you give me some information there?
Yes, sir. The onus to remove now falls upon everybody involved. So all the coaching staff, all the administrative staff, whoever notices that there's a problem now has the power to remove that player from competition or practice and the duty to do that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions from committee? Okay. Representative Wilson.
Could you go into a little bit detail why after there's one concussion that the brain has to kind of have time to relax and get back into normal functioning before it is hit again, and why if you don't do that what happens? Can you go into that a little bit?
Research shows what they refer to as second strike phenomena, second strike syndrome, and research shows that if a student athlete or an athlete in general is not fully healed from the first concussion, that a relatively small innocuous concussion following up that first concussion that's not healed produces an exponentially higher rate of injury. We don't know why yet. We have some theories, but at day 7, if they're not healed, they're going to have a much worse concussion than they do at day 3. We just don't have that data yet. It's coming. It'll be here soon, but it's not out yet. But what we do know is that student athletes who are not healed efficiently from the first concussion are at much greater risk for a catastrophic injury from a second, even innocuous concussion.
And if I could add to that, this bill is asking that the medical provider follow up and make the return to play. There are ways for medical professionals to tease out some of those symptoms that we are not able to visually pick up on, whether it be balance, whether it be cognitive. So there are very, very high level of testing that can be done to say that this student athlete is at their previous level of function. And that can be done, and that's what this bill offers, and we think that's a great thing.
Thank you. Any further question? Okay. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Do we have Jill Hodges online? Jill, you there?
Yes.
Okay. If you would identify yourself for the record and who you represent.
Yes. Thank you, Representative Dick. For the record, my name is Jill Hodges. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Brain Injury Network. I live in Anchorage, but I'm calling from Washington, D.C. at the Rayburn Building right now. I'm calling in support of House Bill 15, and thank you, Representative Dick and committee, for bringing attention to this important topic. As we've learned more through attending conferences and listening to specialists, neuroscientists really have come a long way in better understanding the brain in the last 25 years and really understanding the seriousness of concussion and brain injury. And I've attended, you know, a dozen of brain injury conferences, and I'm here today for the Brain Injury Congressional Task Force Awareness Day, and every booth from the Neuropsychological Association to the Physical Therapy to the neurology, state government, et cetera. They're all promoting more awareness around concussion. And the exciting part is the research really is around concussion, second impact syndrome, and now there's the term chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And we're going to continue to learn more. But what we do know has really been promoted most recently by the NFL and the CDC. And this information has been available to neuroscientists and professionals for quite a few years. And it's just great that this information has now become available to the public. And I really thank the CDC and the NFL for bringing light to that. It's also exciting that state legislators are passing bills that emphasize the importance of brain health, really, and reducing the risk of serious injury. In Alaska, there are 800 Alaskans hospitalized each year with a severe TBI. The major causes are falls, motor vehicle crashes, and assaults. And it's actually a high number, but looking at this number 8 years ago, it was actually much higher. And since 2003, brain injury rates due to motor vehicle crashes has decreased by nearly 40%. And a lot of people have made the correlation between the legislator's decision to pass a seatbelt law and seeing a decrease in severe traumatic brain injuries. And so this is an opportunity for us to make another policy. You know, this is, it is estimated that 3,000 Alaskans visit the emergency department due to concussion or mild traumatic brain injury each year. And this bill, House Bill 15, is a prevention educational tool. And luckily, it has no fiscal notes. And so it's really the most cost-effective way to get this education out to our public. And not only, you know, if this bill passes, will students and athletes and their coaches and athletic directors have more information, but I think parents and teachers will start to understand the importance of returning to school and how once you have a concussion, there's metabolic changes that happen in your brain. And the brain is really in need of nutrients, and one of those being glucose. And so physical effort or mental effort actually can reduce your recovery rate. And so this information is going to get out more, and hopefully it will increase off the field as well. And people will start to recognize the importance of wearing helmets and doing some of those other measurements to decrease the chance of the brain injury. I've spoken with many states that have already passed this bill, and many of them have shared that, you know, the school districts and the community agencies have gone above and beyond what the bill requires voluntarily. Many states are now participating in what's called baselining. And when I say states, there are agencies within those states that are participating in baselining and promoting the importance of having your child baseline for the year so that when a concussion happens, you have very specific personal data to relate that individual to, and to see if really the assessment shows the concussion has taken place. And so House Bill 15 is a very affordable way to reduce the risk of severe traumatic brain injury, which could cause permanent disability, and will also help keep our student-athletes' brains safe. It may even increase awareness about the brain and concussion that kids off the court, field, or rink may better understand how to minimize these serious injuries. The brain truly is an amazing organ, and a healthy brain is so important for academic and vocational success. And I know that's one of the primary issues for this committee. So we encourage you to please support House Bill 15 so our student athletes can continue to maximize their potential and continue to be leaders in our community. And that concludes my testimony for today.
Thank you, Jill. Do you have that in writing?
I do, yes.
If you would fax that to 465-2197, we'd like that for record.
Okay.
Thank you. And any questions from committee for Jill? Okay. Thank you, Jill. Do we have Gary Matthews online?
Yes, I'm here in Anchorage at the LIO.
Okay, if you'd identify yourself for the record and who you represent. Go ahead with your testimony, Gary.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Chairman Dick and the committee. I represent the Alaska School Activities Association, which is an organization of member high schools in Alaska, approximately 200 high schools. We have worked closely with Representative Dugan's office, with the School Boards Association, and the Alaska Association of School Administrators, and we do support the committee substitute. We are standing by, ready to implement this as is specified in the bill. It says the governing body of a school district shall consult with Alaska School Activities Association to develop and publish guidelines and other information to educate coaches, student-athletes, and parents of student-athletes regarding the nature and risk of concussion. We do have a Sports Medicine Advisory Committee, which has been meeting on and discussing and planning how to move forward with concussion management, training, and regulation in Alaska. We've already started doing that. And so this is not new to us. It did not come as a surprise. Our main goal is to protect students and to train coaches, parents, school athletic directors, and we also would like to see school nurses involved in this because frequently in the larger school districts, they are ones involved in the front line. We want to work to make sure this is workable for Alaska. We want to make sure that it's that it, even when we're applying it, that it's that it can be used in rural Alaska, that the village health aides and nurses, that every community has someone who can evaluate in order to be able to return a student to play, because we do not want to create a group of students who are disenfranchised in Alaska, knowing the remoteness and the relative minimal amount of medical coverage available in many of the communities in the state. We're concerned about return to play. We want to make sure that the person who does that is authorized to do that. And it's important that those people be identified, or that there be some way that we can identify that those people are capable and have received adequate training. That one of the things that was brought was mentioned, I think, by Representative Seaton, is what about rules and so forth as far as making things safer. Every high school association in the country is a member of the National Federation of High Schools, including the Alaska School Activities Association. And the majority of the rules that we use for high school sports are rules written by the National Federation of High School Associations, the NFHS. Their main purpose is to protect the students from injury and to maintain standards for the games. And one of the things that we do find in football, for example, in a football rule book, officials, the sports officials, the referees, may remove a student from a game for suspected head injury. And that wasn't mentioned in any of the testimony, but that's an important first step, and frequently that is the first notice of a student who is acting strangely on a football field, and the official will notice it, because the official's right there. Officials can remove the kids at that time. One of the things that was mentioned was cognitive impairment, and that's becoming, as I think that was Joe Hodges mentioned that, that's becoming more better understood around the country now. There are students who are up to a year after a traumatic brain injury, or what we call concussion, are still having problems with school. They may have to have accommodations made for the amount of time they spend in school for their academic challenges. We like the committee substitute concussion because it is more specifically focused on high school sports. The original bill mentioned traumatic brain injury, and we felt that was beyond the scope of our abilities to deal with as a high school activities association. What I think Jill also mentioned baseline testing, which is one brand is called impact testing, and that has been used experimentally in Alaska. A few years ago, the Anchorage School District contracted with Providence, Alaska, to do impact testing of football players, and that was done, a baseline set. And I think there's another school district in the state that's doing that right now, but it's really a very limited process in place right now. There's a cost involved. Schools and communities have not been able or willing to be able to always foot those bills. But part of the problem is that it requires a student to go to a site and be tested, and then after suspected brain injury, to go and be tested again. And with the distance and that schools are from Anchorage or other main centers, it might be prohibitive for a student to do that after a suspected injury. We're very supportive of this bill. We're happy that Representative Dugan's office has worked with us and with other entities to produce the substitute. I did have extensive discussions with the Washington High School Activities Association, Dr. Herring at the Washington University of Washington, the Seattle Seahawks doctor, with the attorney for the Leistat family, with a risk manager in Washington, with our attorney, and with superintendents. I was in Juneau 2 weeks ago at the legislative fly-in and spoke to superintendents about this. The Alaska School Activity Association Board of Directors strongly supports the bill and with the committee substitute and has determined that we're ready to move ahead to implement this with the schools. And in fact, if the bill does not make it clear through and be passed into law this year, we intend to move ahead anyway. That concludes my comments.
Okay. Thank you, Gary. Any question from committee? Representative Seaton.
Thank you. And the question I had earlier was on page, well, basically on page 3, because it says compliance with the protocol for prevention and reporting of concussions under 143142, but I don't see anything in that section that's actually talking about prevention of concussion. It's talking about removing after a concussion so that a person doesn't have a subsequent concussion. So is your testimony that you have currently in the Association of School Boards adequate protocols so that protective gear must be utilized during the, as the association has determined, during those sports in which concussions are likely to occur? Or do we need to look also at the wording here for prevention of concussions?
To the chair, to Representative Seaton, as far as protective gear, that is all specified in the national rules. We have not gone beyond that and developed any supplementary rules, but all sports that have risk for injury as much as possible without altering the fundamental nature of the sport require protective gear, mouthpieces, head injuries, pads, and so forth. One sport that constantly is a challenge all around the country is soccer. Soccer wasn't mentioned I don't think anyone mentioned soccer, but there's a pretty substantial risk of head injury in soccer. And there have been many studies and organizations which have tried to develop some guidelines or some requirements for soccer headgear that won't change the fundamental nature of the sport. And so far, I think all groups have been confounded on that. There's not one that has been adopted. There are different experimental types of soccer headgear, and what I've heard from people trusting them all change the fundamental nature of soccer, which one of the things is heading the ball. The ball is hit with the head. The ball is directed with the head. So as much as possible, the answer is yes. The rules specify what protective gear must be used in high school activities. Many of the youth organizations use the National Federation rules. YMCA, Boys and Girls Club, and so forth use National Federation rules. So I think that as much as possible right now, the students are protected as much as they can be. I'm looking at back on the page 2 under line 17 and 16 says the nature and risks of concussions. I assume that I take that to mean not just inevitably we're going to be concussions, but we need to notify people that there are risks of concussions, and there are certain ways that those can be reduced. One of the things is I think that Brenda Sheldon mentioned a program called Heads Up. There are ways to teach how to tackle in football that reduce the risk of head injuries, and those things are already included in the rules, and we will continue to emphasize safer ways of competing, which may, in addition to wearing protective gear, training coaches how to train kids to do things in a safer manner, which hopefully will eliminate some of the concussions that we see today.
Okay, thank you. Any other Representative Kawasaki?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for being online today. Since you represent ASA, I had a question about schools and how they currently operate. Do all schools currently have a qualified person, is how it's defined in the bill, present during a game, say for football, soccer, hockey? guess all the sports where you might expect a traumatic injury or a concussion.
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, I would say the answer to that is all schools. The answer is no. In the high, the most high-risk sports, which would be hockey, football, wrestling, I think those are the ones probably have the highest risks. We recommend that, but there are many areas which don't have those people standing by. Usually they are available with a call. We ask schools to notify the local EMS when there are going to be sports activities so people can be standing by. With the training for coaches and parents and so forth that we are emphasizing is anyone has the opportunity to recognize traumatic brain injury, or I should say concussion in a student. And there are signs observable by coaches, being dazed, confused, forgetting about plays, unsure of the game, you're moving clumsily and so forth. There's a list of things that hopefully coaches will be able to use these lists, and they have been, to determine right away whether the kid needs further evaluation, whether there happens to be someone on the sideline or not. And the intention is, if student exhibits a suspected concussion, that the student is not going to go back to play until the student has been cleared, authorized to do so. Right now in Alaska, if a student is suspected of concussion, the student is not allowed to return to play on that day. We've already taken that step. That's up and beyond anything in this House Bill 15. So schools already know that, and so we're working on that. But it's probably not possible to have a licensed provider at every contest. Most schools in Alaska do not have certified athletic trainers. I think that the trainers listening in would probably be able to give you an indication of how many in the state. I would say less than 10% of our high schools in Alaska have certified athletic trainers on staff or available to them. It's just a fact of the supply and demand.
Thank you, and I can't blame it on a concussion, but I did overlook Peggy, Representative Wilson here. Representative Wilson, thank you for giving me that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question, and I don't know how. I know in my town, the kids, before they can be in athletic, even take part, that they have to have some kind of a physical. And my question is, I don't know what they do in areas where there's not a physician available, but I was thinking that eventually maybe we could get the impact testing or the baselining done during that physical so that it would be included at that time, so that if they had something, some kind of a concussion or something, that they could go back to that same physician and take that same whatever the testing was to see, you know, where they're at with their concussion. And I don't know how available that would be or how costly that would be.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, this is Gary Matthews. Every student in the state must have a pre-participation sports physical exam annually prior to participation in high school sports. And that's done different ways in different communities. Of course, in the larger communities, it's very simple. You go to a doctor and have it done. In rural Alaska, sometimes it means flying physicians into a community. It may mean sending the kids to a site. Sometimes a wrestling team is going to wrestle somewhere. They'll to a larger town. They'll have all the kids have their sports physicals when they get to that community. It is a challenge in rural Alaska. I will not deny that. But it is the rule. And it's done. As far as the impact testing, my understanding is there are very few people in Alaska who are qualified to administer the test or to evaluate the results of the test. And maybe someone else on there that's there can speak in more detail to that.
Okay. Thank you. We're getting a little bit short on time here. I want to, Superintendent Nygaard, are you there in Cordova? Good morning. Is Peter there also with you?
Yes, he is.
if you don't mind, I have we have a little bit of a time crunch here. If you'd like to testify for maybe 5 minutes, and then the at the end of this, the public testimony is going to remain open. But if you don't mind my budgeting you to 5 minutes, if you'd testify, and then we need to shift gears at 9:35, and again, the public testimony will remain open. So for the record, please identify yourself and who you represent.
Association Gary Matthews. I'd like to give the superintendent's perspective, and I do need to clarify and emphasize that I do appreciate the ongoing hearings on this bill, including the amendments. Again, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 15. It's a great time of the year in Alaska. After a long season of basketball games, the state playoffs are just around the corner. Sports, especially basketball, are the glue that helps keep many of our smaller communities together during the long winters. And what a celebration each weekend is when we can gather with friends and neighbors to enjoy a friendly rivalry on the court. Truly a great time for the superintendent of schools. At that point, I know where all my kids are. Can you imagine the pain felt among the crowd when our athletes struggle for the ball and one is no longer capable to regain his composure and come to his feet? We've all seen this, and we've all gasped in disbelief and denial it could happen on our court in front of all of us. Now imagine the coach, the players, and the parents. The many things that race through our brains at the time when a student athlete is sprawled on the floor trying to recover from a collision. There will never be a time when we are all more vulnerable and in need of a structured approach to ensure that that student athlete will successfully recover. From this point, the final score means nothing, as long as the student athlete is capable of recovering. We're not doctors, nor can we guarantee that a doctor will always be present. I appreciate the sponsor's effort to see the necessary language and the amendments reflect a qualified person, as with many communities, a licensed physician is not always available. Getting this language clarified has been monumental for all the schools involved in these conversations. As with all human nature, education is key. Getting the information out to the public will benefit all parties. Necessary sign-offs of the nature of risks of concussions by parents and student-athletes will complement the need for all parties to be better prepared to deal with potential concussions. Legislative influence will add consistency to the adherence of this bill as well. At a time when information is readily available via our internet, we have limited reasons not to be better informed, nor to be more proactive, especially when it has to do with the well-being of our young population. I support this bill as it moves forward and appreciate the committee's time as you've listened to similar testimony throughout the morning. Again, Jim Nygaard, Superintendent of Schools in Cordova. Thank you.
5 minutes. Perfect. Any quick questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you. And again, the public testimony will remain open. Thank you. We do have testifiers here in the room, and I don't want to insult anybody, but I think we got the folks that have been needed to travel to get here. So, very good. We're going to put HB 15 aside for further review, and I'll give notice when it be scheduled, and hopefully soon. Looks like a winner. So, thank you. We do want to deal with HB 104. I'm really interested in us understanding this, and then and moving it on. I've asked, I'm pretty visual, so I put together a PowerPoint presentation. Sheila, if you could put that on the wall, please. And I've asked Representative Seaton, who has a lot of history with this bill, far deeper than my own, and I've asked Diane Behrens also, not that they have conflicting views or anything else, but just to give their own personal views of this. The plan is that we will take we'll have each of them discuss. There's four pages here. I believe this will get us all on the same, literally on the same page, and hopefully next Monday, following Monday, we're going to address this, item 1, 2, 3, 4, and we'll be able to as a committee, make a decision and pass it out of committee next Monday. So With that, Representative Seaton, do you have your do you have your laser pointer?
Yes, right here.
There you go.
I've got two, in fact, if somebody else needs one.
Diane, would you want to sit by Sheila here? And basically, we're just going to, this is my understanding, and they can correct me if I'm wrong. Maybe we have Representative Seaton describe how he understands this, Diane describe it, and we'll, once we have that understanding, we'll move on. I'd like to hold questions to the end because I'd like to get to the end. So this is... Okay, so Representative Seaton, would you might want to just start and give your understanding of this page?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, you know, basically this is saying how the program developed and what happened through the in 2010. We went through the House and the Senate in the Education Committees. They both developed basically, in the end, identical bills that had a House that had a merit section. And a needs-based section, and then when that went to, and it was developed so that the all of the scholarships down here would be taken first, and then the merit-based scholarship would be the last dollars in. The hope is that in most cases, those scholarships, loans, and other portions here would actually encompass for most people all of that, so that there wouldn't be an unmet need. However, in those cases where there is an unmet need that is determined by the FAFSA, that's the federal
application
for free
student aid.
Yeah. Anyway, the one we everybody uses, that would be conducted, and that then subtracts out all the asset. And everything else that are the ability of a family to pay, and then you have an unmet need. And what we had determined was that we would subtract $2,000 as a work commitment by students, because students can work for 15 hours without affecting their grades in college. And so then we had the remainder of the unmet need, and the bill that was went out of the House and Senate said that we would look at 50% of the of that unmet need would be the needs-based component of the merit scholarship. And that is where we went to. And we didn't have Alaska Advantage in at the time. However, that doesn't mean that we hadn't talked about the non-traditional student. We had talked at a number of meetings about non-traditional students and how to incorporate those. And we just couldn't figure out how to incorporate into one program, incorporate the non-traditional student with the qualifications that were relevant to the merit-based scholarship. And of course, remember, this needs-based portion here only applies to those that receive the merit scholarship. And the basis for having that needs-based component was to allow those that earned the merit scholarship and that had a family situation, economic situation, where they wouldn't be able to use that scholarship because they didn't have the assets, they couldn't get loans, they couldn't, you know, had used all this grant and there was still this unmet need, to have the program help utilize those merit scholarships that those kids had earned. So that was the basis of this. Of course, what we were kind of doing was trying to work with the scholarship that had come forward, which was the governor's performance scholarship was the label at the time, and that was a mirror of the Hathaway scholarship in Wyoming, which is a merit-based. But when that came to Alaska as the governor's performance scholarship, the one piece that was left out was the needs-based component in the Hathaway scholarship. So the Hathaway scholarship, which had the, a $400 million endowment in Wyoming, had both a merit and a needs-based component. And we looked at this and decided that we needed to have the needs-based component. And I think you've got passed out to you just the college participation rates across the United States for students from low-income families in 1993 through 2006, and you'll notice that Alaska is 51, that's including the District of Columbia, so we're last as far as participation in college by students from low-income families, and not only were last, but we're half of what the 50th one is. So we are 7.9% compared to everything that the next lowest is 14.2%. And so we do not have a needs-based program that is robust in the state to allow that to happen. And so that's why that was incorporated in the bill.
Thank you. Diane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Diane Behrens. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Commission on Postsecondary Education. I don't have a lot to add to what Representative Seaton has described. There was, I think, my characterization of the discussion around the needs-based program would be slightly different. I do see that program as a program that, if adequately funded, addresses all low-income students and not simply non-traditional. What I recall being the repeated concern on the part of legislators was that, given the history of the funding of that program, the concern was that these dependent students who typically, through the FAFSA formula, there is an expectation of family contribution as well as a student's contribution to their cost of education, that they fell in such a low area on the needs list that we would not get to them. So I think the concern was this, on the part of the legislatures, was this was a way to provide certainty to needs-based supplemental aid to these merit scholars. The concern that I expressed, there were really two, and ones that I maintain today, is that this does create extra complexity in a system that I think simplicity can best address, and that is by funding both programs, leaving the programs separate and distinct, one being a merit program, the other being a needs-based program, that there is clarity both to the legislators as the appropriators to funding. They know what their funding is going to with respect to each program. But it also is simpler to the public to understand, how do I access funds through this program, and how am I eligible for funds through this program? They can work well together. And to the extent that if you actually fund both programs at an adequate level, the students that do get the merit aid, do qualify for that, will also be eligible for the needs-based program. So that was the position I took last year, but it really, Representative Seaton is correct, it really did not get traction until the bill had passed out of the education committees in either body and began to be examined at the finance committee level.
Thank you. Next slide. Oh, I'm sorry.
Let's
hold questions. Yeah. We can ponder and chat over the weekend. Here we go. Next slide. Representative Seaton, you want to address that?
Sure. And I guess what I'll just say is that we're looking at the House and Senate version. And, of course, remember what happened was the House and Senate didn't come together because the funding mechanism that was proposed was unacceptable to the finance committees, and so the merit scholarship portion got rolled into another bill that was actually Senate Bill 221, which was establishing a task force on higher education, and then there was rolled into that a task force to specifically look at the scholarship funding and the program. And so the two committee bills were left, and there was just negotiations within the Senate that came out with a bill that had the program of the scholarship so that regulations could be started, they could start writing regulations and we wouldn't have to wait for another year. The task force to identify funding mechanisms, and that's the first place where Alaska Advantage got incorporated, and that got incorporated with a fairly with some money into the Alaska Advantage program to help give it some money. However, the Alaska Advantage program typically has been with non-traditional students. Those are the guidelines because it's the most needy. The other part was that in the bill, the fiscal note for both the House and Senate bills, it was about $20 million would be the merit section, and about $17 million was the fiscal note. I could have those reversed, was going to be the needs-based component. And so when we looked at that later, it's like, okay, if we do this and we have a merit-based scholarship that's $20 million, and we take one, you know, half of that or $10 million for a needs-based component, how can $10 million satisfy the high school students that are going to qualify for this merit-based, that $20 million amount, and the additional amount for the needs-based students, and have that $10 million satisfy a more than $20 million fiscal note? And so we've never seen the new fiscal note based on capping the non. There was a problem because the needs-based portion assumed that there would be growth over time of the cost of going to college, and so there was a small component put in for that, but that wasn't the major component. And so what we have here is, again, we'll have a merit scholarship that will have a needs-based component that will probably be less than half of the needs-based component that's going to be needed for the high school students, much less the non-traditional students. So that is why the problem with the Senate bill that we had, and of course this Senate bill that we, this is what's being proposed now, and I don't know that I should even be really talking about that too much, but because this is what the task force recommendations were, is that we should have both things funded under one funding source, that there should be a needs-based component for the merit scholarships, that there should be a separate Alaska Advantage for non-traditional students that is funded in the same mechanism as the House and Senate. And so that's, and I think you all have the copies of the task force recommendations, and those are rolled right from this is rolled right from the task force recommendations.
Thank you. Diane?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Diane Behrens. I guess the one point I would speak to is the task force recommendations. And although clearly in the end there was deference to the recommendations coming from members of the legislature, there was not consensus. As a task force member, I would say there was not consensus that the best approach was to add a needs-based supplement to the merit program. Certainly in both the presentation that I provided to the task force at the request of the chair, I really do feel that there is a likelihood of creating competition on the point of needs, whether or not in times of less than adequate funding availability, if we have a needs portion built into the merit scholarship, that it will create a tension between the two programs. And then the question before the legislature will be, well, do we deny supplemental need to our merit scholars, or do we put the larger population at risk, those students that have no access to the merit scholarship because of the structure, would then be at risk of not having access to adequate needs-based aid because there's a needs-based component within the merit scholarship. So I you know, that was my position as a member of the task force, and I would maintain that, that there is concern about that.
Representative Seaton?
Yeah, and I'd just like to agree with Diane that there is this tension, but our job was first of all to make sure that we had a merit-based program, that the needs could be satisfied so that those students could use the needs-based component. And exactly what Diane is saying is there might be tension between those non-merit students and other needy students, and you want to provide for the non-merit-based students. Well, that wasn't the entire program. The entire program was to say we're going to have kids reach for this merit-based scholarship, knowing that if they do it and if they have needs, we will help on those needs. So if we now say we want to make sure that there's not tension so that if you qualify for a merit-based student, it may be other students that have need that will get the needs-based component, so you're left out. So you have no security that if you work hard, take this rigorous curriculum, perform well, and qualify for that, that if you have needs that aren't going to prevent you from going to college or to a certificate, you're not going to have any assurance because you're thrown in the pool with all the rest. And so that's why designing the program as it was, that there would be a needs-based component to the merit scholarship, assured those high school students that were engaging in that rigorous curriculum that they would have the access to college. Rolling in the Alaska Advantage program as a separate program at least assures that those students that aren't in that category of current high school students, there is a program specifically designed for those, and the task force wanted to have the program funded under the same mechanisms so that we would make sure that we weren't just providing money for the merit scholarship needs-based component and for getting the other, so that we would get adequate funding for both. That was the goal.
Response?
Yeah, and my response would be I certainly understand the intent behind those interested in seeing an entitlement created under the merit program. But I think there is a dilemma in creating an entitlement to both the merit and the needs component for a small sector of students. And I think that that is something that many legislators would be concerned about. I think there is a sense with the merit scholarship that there is a pact being created between the legislature and the students who have engaged in a particular curriculum. And to raise the price tag in the entitlement program as opposed to the needs-based program, it does create a concern. When there are only so many dollars on the table, do you put them solely in the program that folks have entered into this agreement to make, and they have done their part, and now the legislature feels obligated, and not inappropriately so, to make sure that the support is there for them. I think there is more flexibility from year to year in dealing with funding fluctuations if you have a smaller commitment to the entitlement program so that you can have more discretion in how the other funds are spent.
Thank you. Next slide. Can I speak to this really quick? Yeah. I'm very visual, so I need a flow chart, I need a graph, I need something to see. And it just seemed to me that there was three choices: draw from Amerita Hess, draw from the general fund, and one, don't designate a funding source. But that was best one of the tasks of the task force, was to point out a funding source. And so by not designating where the money would come from, one, it would be shirking our duty. Well, we could say finance can do it, but last year's task force was assigned to identify funding sources. So I think, although I put that up as an option, that's really, I don't see it as an option. And we do need to address either Amerita Hess or General Fund as to where that money would come from. Representative Seaton?
Thank you, and I think that you're identifying the problems. If we don't designate and we do like we are, we have $8.5 million this year in a merit base. It may be there next year. It may not be if kids are going to work, and maybe the legislature will appropriate every year, or maybe they won't. That was seen as very risky to try and form a contract with students when there is no kind of directed funding. There was absolute, even though the Hathaway plan, this was kind of modeled after, at least the merit section was modeled after, had established in Wyoming a $400 million endowment. That was just totally unacceptable to the finance committees in the House and the Senate. I mean, that just, and there still is unacceptability, big resistance among folks of putting in, and $400 million wouldn't do it anyway if you're talking merit and needs-based or merit and Alaska Advantage. In any case, you need at least $600 million to spin out at 5%, $30 million. So what we were left with was what the task force recommended, and they said there were the task force recommends the sources of funding for the scholarship be positively identified, funds in revenue be firmly designated, and they listed a category, and those were designating interest from specified existing accounts, and Amaretta Hess, its earnings from Amaretta Hess, not just interest. Second thing was designating program receipts and dividends, and you know, I passed out again to everybody the chart of what we have in the CS, because we identified, and it was much at the insistence of Representative Fairclough, that we look towards our non-renewable resources generating revenues that were funding these scholarships, so we had students understanding that oil and gas and mining were the things that were generating their scholarships. That was fairly, you know, we talked about it around the table. There wasn't, and the progressivity part from the oil and gas tax was put in there as a direct link so that students receiving these scholarships would understand that. Now, whether that becomes an issue, and it was just one mechanism. If people want to figure out another way or backfill with general funds, that's fine. But that's why the Amaretta Hess was there. And there's approximately, I think it was $52 million, $53.3 million was in the Amaretta Hess Capital Income Fund is what it was called, where this money was going in that fund that hasn't been spent. And so that could form the basis of the new fund for funding the Alaska Advantage and the Performance Scholarship Fund. And so that's where the task force came from, and that's what we put into the CS.
Thank you. Diane.
Mr. Chair, Diane Behrens, the only comment I would make is that I think from the governor's perspective, all state funds are state funds, and depending on what your preference is for funding the program, his objective was to identify a subfund in the general fund, the investment earnings of which could support the merit program. That's what was in the original bill. The sort of two similar approaches being used in the different CSs in the House and the other body take another approach. The governor understands that as long as the principles that he was seeking to achieve, which was predictability and an ongoing funding source, could be established, that you would have achieved the specific goals. In terms of speaking to kind of the nuances of the funds, I would certainly, and strategies, I would certainly defer to Jerry Burnett, the Deputy Commissioner of Revenue, who's here today.
It's 10 o'clock.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Seaton,
I'd just like to say, just so everybody understands, that what this funding source in the CS is it's built on the revenue sharing model. So it's $160 million that would spin out. And if we decided not to make a deposit into that in a single year, there would still be enough to pay the full commitment for another year. And then only if the legislature decided it wasn't going to, in a second year, make a deposit, then that would still have enough money to wind down the commitments that we've made to each qualifying student, but it wouldn't be enough to take additional students in. So you have enough in that mechanism to do that. The other aspect is that, like the task force identified, you could do a constitutional amendment for an endowment fund. Didn't seem to be appetite for that. The other was a separate fund, the $400 million or $600 million. It would take at least $600 million, and finance committee members have indicated that they were unwilling to do it that way. So that's why the revenue sharing model was adopted.
With respect to everybody else's schedules, I think we do need to adjourn. And we will pick this up next Monday, and we're gonna narrow this down, and it's hopefully it's just up and down on four issues, and hopefully we can move it on. So, Diane, thank you. Representative Seaton, thank you. And I hope to meet with the rest of the committee members, get your input, get your thoughts. This is a committee. So,